Okay, so Mike gave a good introduction about sort of the numerical simulation aspect of this game of sort of astrophysical Milky Way dark matter. So my talk's really actually going to be more focused on sort of observation and data analysis. If you go back to the sort of like quote that I always quote in these contexts by Martin Rees, particle physics is like a fine game of chess, astrophysics is mud wrestling. Okay, so this is actually going to be mud wrestling a little bit, but ultimately what we want to know is we want to understand what's going on in astrophysics so we can actually determine what properties. So the work that I'm actually going to be talking about is done with my collaborator Roberto Trotta. This is actually based on sort of a serendipitous, this whole project based on a serendipitous meeting we had at the CERN cafeteria earlier this year, so you never know how things materialize. I guess that's the bottom line. So this is a workshop, so my goal for workshops is always to show figures and or results that are not published, whether they be correct or not. So I'm actually going to do that as well here too, additionally showing some things that hopefully are correct. So sort of the theme here is the outline is to sort of review observational evidence that we live in a dark matter halo. Okay, what are the properties of that dark matter halo? Okay, so then what can we do to use that information to sort of reconstruct these properties that we care about in sort of these standard sort of vanilla type WIMP models. And at the end of the day, I'll talk a little bit about this analytic framework I've been working on to sort of map sort of direct sort of observations of halo profiles to velocity distributions and direct detection experiments so we can actually maybe do dark matter astronomy. So I actually don't need to review this because Mike essentially talked about everything here. So this is the velocity distribution from the Aquarius simulation. Just the things that I find interesting here, or the claim here is, I think Mike talked a little bit about this, was these sort of coherent wiggles that they see sort of in the velocity structure of the dark matter particles in the halo. So if we could ever get to the stage where we detect enough events in WIMP experiments, we could potentially observe and resolve these sort of coherent wiggles in the velocity distribution, and maybe you learn a little bit about the formation of the Milky Way halo. So that's kind of the ultimate goals, but of course the big thing is, right, what trumps it all is like we want to know what the WIMP is, what its mass is, what its interactions are, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this is just the same figure Mike showed about the substructure and how it's actually not likely to be a big deal sort of on our local environment. Okay, so what I'm actually going to talk about is I'm actually not really going to address the issues of substructure or galactic or structure on sort of like scales of a few parsecs like we care about for direct detection experiments, because we're really sort of observations I think are kind of far away from actually probing that kind of structure. So what I will talk about is the evidence that we live in a massive dark matter halo, and I'm not going to show plots of the CMB spectrum with like omega matter equal to 0.3. I'm actually going to show pictures of stars moving around, right, and gravitational potentials, and deducing the mass of the matter that you get from the stars. And unfortunately, this is completely invisible, but you have to believe me here that the local group consists of two. It's a dark matter workshop, right? So you have to believe me that the local group consists of two extremely massive dark matter halos, the Milky Way and M31 and a bunch of other smaller galaxies. So the simplest thing you can do to determine what the mass of the local group was, and this calculation actually dates back to the 1950s, it's called the timing argument, is to say, okay, these two galaxies were initially right on top of each other at the Big Bang, they started expanding, okay, eventually this whole region of the local group collapsed, and then eventually you have a two-body problem. Okay, with the Milky Way and M31 storming towards each other. Okay, so basically you just do dynamics of that two-body problem, and you need to know what essentially the velocity of these objects are coming towards each other, maybe the proper motion between them, and the distance between these two objects, and then you can actually just deduce the mass of the local group, and this was done many years ago, and the number still sticks around, about 5 times 10 to the 12 solar masses of matter here in the entire local group distributed between M31 and Milky Way. So now if you look at sort of more detailed picture of around each galaxy, sort of satellite observations, sort of the motions of the satellites around the Milky Way and M31 says probably the M31 is maybe a factor of 2 more massive or so than Milky Way. Okay, that's a pretty good estimate. I'll talk in more detail about that in a second. So basically, this is just the general idea. Okay, so we believe just sort of from just general grounds of dynamics that there's a large amount of dark matter in the local group, And of course, we're here to try to detect that. OK, so how do we know that we, in itself, the Milky Way, live in a dark matter halo? Well, OK, what you can actually do is, so there's recent measurements of about 2,000 or so blue horizontal branch stars out to 60 kiloparsecs by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So here's sort of like the Sloan, the region that they observe, these patches here. So why to use these stars to map the dark matter halo? Okay, well, the dynamics are really simple because these are just essentially test particles in a massive halo. Okay, so it's just sort of simple, you know, Jeans equation type analysis. This component's not rotating at all. Okay, this is just sort of a, you know, effectively a pressure supported type analysis. And what you can get is you determine what the entire mass of the halo is from these stars. And so here's a circular velocity curve that's plotted out from this analysis. And these different components here are the different components of the that contribute sort of to the mass of the Milky Way. There's a bulge component, of course. There's a disk component, and then there's like the massive halo. And each one of these are dynamically different. So here's the bulge, okay. Here's the disk, and here's the dark matter halo. And you sum them all up, and you get something like this black curve. And there's different models. You know, you can assume adiabatic contraction, not adiabatic contraction. You know, this is ultimately a model-dependent analysis, but at the end of the day, your data is telling you, you know, the circular velocity is something like 200, 220 kilometers per second for the Milky Way. And this is sort of data that we have to fit. So now an important point to this, well, actually, there's two important points. One is we're going to use this a lot in our analysis. And two, so the sort of like the circular velocity using these measurements goes down to maybe, eight kiloparsecs or so. That's sort of like the last point that these stars trace in the halo. And they're sort of like in the northern cap, okay. So they're really not confined to the disk. So the way this analysis was done is they purposely extracted stars from the disk, okay, just to make sure that these things were not actually part of the galactic disk and not rotating. Okay, so you know, this is a pretty exquisite measurement. So if we want to know what's the mass of the halo and what's its properties, you know, is it NFW? Is it something different? Okay, this is actually a pretty good data set to use in this context. So I actually will be using this shortly when we do a likelihood analysis. Sort of another important piece of information that comes into not only direct detection calculations, but sort of dynamics of the Milky Way is what's the galactic escape velocity. Okay, so how is that measured? So it's measured by just looking at a handful of stars with sort of anomalously large radio velocities in the local neighborhood. Okay, so this is just a group of stars measured by this RAVE survey, sort of within the local kiloparsec or so. Okay, so now if you look at these stars and you assume that these are actually bound to the halo, okay, you can actually use these to calculate what's the local escape velocity. So that's actually what they did here in this analysis in 2007, and you know, in its nuts and bolts, you have to sort of parameterize what the phase space density is of these stars, and you sort of do this in this relatively model independent way, and you have sort of a two parameter problem here where you're trying to determine what the escape velocity is, and here's sort of the best fitting values that they determined, maybe a little less than 600 kilometers per second or so. Okay, so this is just right. So this is just kind of, I mean, when you think about it, sort of in its detail, right? This is just a really, you know, you look at a handful of stars around sort of, you know, the solar system here, kiloparsecs or so scales, and you can actually deduce that we actually live in a pretty extended massive dark matter halo. K. No, K is just a parameter here. Yeah. Are you asking for sort of physical reason for it? No, it's just a way to do analysis. Yeah. It's how sharp the cutoff is. Yeah. 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 That's. Oh, not in the context of this analysis, it wasn't like anything physical. No. Yeah. Okay. So this is probably hard to see, actually. So we kind of went from like larger scales, and now we're kind of going into smaller scales around the galactic disk area. So this is sort of an interesting analysis. I think this made some headlines earlier in the year. So there are some results using motions of sort of star-forming regions and gas clouds in the disk to show that the Milky Way circular velocity was actually larger than sort of the canonical value of 220 kilometers per second or so. So this was done in this Reed et al. Paper. So actually, sort of an interesting side note about this paper. So this is actually an artist image of the Milky Way, and this is sort of where their measurements of their gas clouds are. So this actually appeared in an AppJ paper, which I think was kind of interesting. This is like the first sort of artist image of the Milky Way I've ever seen appear in a journal. But I guess, you know, that's the way it is these days. But so if you want to measure sort of the rotation curve sort of in the disk region, you use these gas clouds. Okay, so and this is where this new result came to be. But if you actually, so right, so 240 kilometers per second was their result here. Sort of a reanalysis of this problem looks and says, okay, there's lots of degenerate parameters, and what you really need to do in this problem is a maximum likelihood analysis, of course, right, to, you know, throw sort of all the galactic model parameters together and determine these parameters simultaneously. This was done, for example, in a follow-up paper by McMillan and Binney, who looked at how the sort of circular velocity is degenerate with the distance to the galactic center, actually, for example, sort of in a very relatively model-independent way. So basically, all I kind of want to highlight in this particular figure is that it's sort of important to sort of, you know, look at this data really generally and sort of analyze it all at once if we actually like want to.
Best bit value is 7.2 kiloparsecs.
Yeah, this is just this is actually invisible. So this is a little over 7 kiloparsecs, but this is for a specific model of the rotation curve, like how it rises, the circular velocity, how it rises as a function of r. What's that? I'm sorry. This is circular velocity. This is distance. This is 2. You know, I can't even see it actually. Okay. Yeah, it's 220. Yeah. Right. Okay. So yeah. So this is just going to serve as sort of motivation for going forward here. And sort of, there's one other sort of astrophysical piece of dark matter that I'm going to throw in here because it's gotten a little bit of attention recently, and it's been sort of a subject that's been visited the past century or so, going back to Oort and Bacall in the 30s and 80s. So essentially, is there any dynamical dark matter in the disk? Okay, is there any dark matter in the disk that's dynamically important? Okay, so that's basically the question that has been answered for a while. And basically, what is used here to measure this is these sort of K giant stars, these sort of like long-lived stars that are sort of well mixed into galactic potential. And you can actually determine sort of what the vertical force is, just sort of in a standard Newtonian type analysis above the galactic disk. Okay, so this is sort of what this vertical force law looks like. So this is actually turns out to be pretty well constrained at about a kiloparsec or so above the disk. So this is like the nominal number that people quote when doing dynamical modeling here. And it turns out, if you just sort of look at the luminous matter in the disk, right, and you compare it to what's dynamically important, it turns out that pretty much all the matter, all the matter that you see is that's basically all that's dynamically relevant. Okay, there's really not much room in the dynamics for any dark matter, significant dark matter component in the disk of the Milky Way. Okay, so the reason why that's important is because, as Mike talked a little bit about, there's been some noise made about there might be a dark matter disk in the Milky Way that gets formed when a massive satellite comes in and merges with the Milky Way at an appropriate angle. Okay, and then it sort of like mixes into the disk component, and this would have kinematics that resemble the kinematics of the thick disk of the Milky Way. Okay. So the question, observationally, you know, it's pretty difficult task to determine whether this exists or not. But the main interest here is that disk component would of course be rotating. Okay, it would have different sort of signals in direct detection experiments relative to this sort of standard halo. Okay. So. That's sort of like an overview, I think, of where we are at this stage for like the dynamics of the Milky Way. So basically, the idea that we're going to go forward with here is sort of like throw this in to like a big sort of maximum likelihood analysis that sort of marginalizes over sort of all this mess and all this uncertainty, and see, you know, how these errors sort of propagate into determinant of dark matter parameters such as mass and cross section here. So so the question here, the first question we can ask that's important for this is, yeah. Yeah, it's always some model, right? The question, right? So can you ask the latter part again? I wasn't sure what you were getting at.
My understanding is that you use some model for how the
Essentially, yeah, that's true. So this is the, all of the matter in all of the disk components. So there's this that component extends out to beyond about a kiloparsec or so. So the region within about a kiloparsec, that's what the claim is, that that's the most model independent measurement. I mean, of course, you always have to assume something, right? But the question is, what depends least upon the model parameters? And I think it's that region. There's probably a little bit of wiggle room. Yeah. I mean, I think if you sort of go back through this literature, it's like kind of a confusing mess here. There's sort of, you know, rebuttals to all these papers and determine, there's a group of people, I think, that said that, you know, there actually might be a component of dark matter that's actually not insignificant.
Wait, so if growth level is 0.3, if I took a dark disk of 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter in the thick disk, then how much does that correspond to when I add it up like this?
It can't be of order one, basically. Right.
I just want to know if I assume that the dark disk was equal to the halo, the smooth Mackel-Boltzmann halo,
mm-hmm.
how much does that add up to total matter in these units?
I think it's about a factor of two or so less. So the surface density of the matter associated with the visible component is about a factor of two. It's about 0.1. Well, solar masses per parsec cubed, which is an order of magnitude larger than. Yeah.
So it's 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter, the solar mass per parsec cubed?
0.01. So what's
0.01.
Is that right? Did I get that right? Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That still just seems like there's plenty of
room. Yeah. But this is a surface density. This is you have to be careful about the units here.
Oh.
Yeah. This is a surface density of matter. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Surface density matter in the entire disk, right?
No, it's about 1,000.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So basically, this is sort of the idea to do a Monte Carlo scan of sort of the data, and try to determine sort of what our best fitting parameters are. And this is sort of some initial results. And actually, this work goes back to sort of the 90s and more recently with Denon and Binney actually were the first people to look at this in this context. So here's sort of an example of a scan using some of the previous data. So basically, all right, here's the local density in units that we all can understand. So the width is, I think, pretty robust. Right, using all this data, once again, assuming that the halo is smooth. Okay, assuming that we live in a halo that looks, you know, like an NFW profile, but sort of marginalizes over sort of the exact value of the inner slope and the outer slope of the halo. Circular velocity again is close to 220 kilometers per second. You know, sort of with standardish error bars. Oh, yeah, ignore these for the time being. Yeah, anyway, go ahead. Yeah, so given this model, right? So given this model that we, you know, in those observations that I outlined previously, right? And we sort of live in something that looks, you know, in modest shape like an NFW profile, like an NFW halo. Yeah, that is actually a true statement, yeah. So I guess there was a little bit of noise made earlier because there was this result that said the local density was this to within a very small error. I think that result was obtained using sort of a very specific halo model. Okay. But you know, this is not bad. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, those guys. Yeah. I think there was a little bit of an underestimation in the errors that went on. Oh yeah, so the mean values aren't off, but sort of like how wide that distribution is, right? It's different. Okay, so you know, this is kind of an interesting academic question, but ultimately what we really wanted to do was sort of feed this into a direct detection calculation. Yeah. I guess it depends on what you mean by model independently. Oh, That's a little bit hard. By non-monotonic, you mean maybe there's like wiggles in the velocity distribution. That's actually hard to model, just sort of like from sort of simple kinematics. I guess right. The thing you would do is you'd get back to this argument, right? That people were having. You'd say, okay, you know, if I just look right around the sun, is there dark matter just from looking at motions of objects? And I think, you know, the answer is there does not have to be. Right. If your evidence for dark matter was based on that, then, you know, you probably wouldn't go very far. But I mean, that's not inconsistent with the total picture of, right? Yeah. Right before. Yeah. Did that answer your question? There's no way what? Yeah, there's no, at least from dynamics, right? Measure, direct detection. Yeah. Okay, so I argued to that. Okay, so basically just, I guess there's been a sort of approaches, so I guess, yeah, I wanted to jump from here to how to constrain WIMP properties. And there's been some approaches in the past that have sort of just used you know, large exposures of data that are expected in future experiments, for example, germanium and xenon and things like this, and ask, okay, how well can you, like, if you measure a WIMP, right, no argument about it's there, right? Like, if you measure it, like, how well can you actually constrain the mass in cross-section? So here's just some example of some work that's been done. This is, I'll just point to this paper by Annie Green, who sort of just the general trend here is that at low masses you get better constraints on the particle properties than you do at high masses because of form factors, et cetera. This is just assuming sort of standard type calculations. This would be like with hundreds of events, yeah, 10 to 100. Can you say it again? This one's with germanium. This one's with xenon. This paper recently, right? Yeah, you definitely get more information with two different types. So that's actually one of the things we think is interesting, sort of like how, if sort of bananas might cross if you look at two different experiments. Yeah. So, can I continue? Okay. So this is kind of a result. This is sort of a, you know, one of these in prep figures that. Okay, if you have like a ton scale detector of germanium, xenon. So I'm going to use xenon for all my fiducial examples, basically because when I first started this, I was talking to xenon people. So if you have sort of ton scale xenon type detectors, here's xenon. Well, actually, here's germanium too. So forget what I just said. But anyway, so here's sort of like your distribution of expected event rates, right? Sort of assuming a 100 GeV WIMP, sort of a 10⁻⁹ picobarn cross section. Okay, so basically this width just comes from sort of just uncertainty sort of in halo models. Okay, so this is sort of the distribution of counts you'd expect in each case, and of course there's more events in xenon than there would be in germanium for these types of detectors. Okay, so the idea is like to get these systematics under control. And so here's now kind of what we want, I guess. What are the projected constraints on masses and cross sections? So this is sort of a model we constructed using not real data but fake data, because if you're a theorist, the first thing you do, I guess, is to make up data. So assuming we have a 50 GeV WIMP in a 10⁻⁹ picobarn cross section, essentially, you know, how well can you measure it, assuming accounting for all uncertainty, sort of in the astrophysical halo model? And this is you know, what these large bananas represent. You can ignore the smaller bananas for now. So basically, you know, if you're interested in knowing what mass particle you have, and of course, if you have a fiducial 500 GeV WIMP for the same cross section, you know, your model would be much actually less well constrained. Yeah, that and form factor, right? Yeah, and fewer events, right? Fewer events. So. This is 10⁻⁹ picobarns. So 10⁻⁴5. Yeah. The difference between is a WIMP mass. Yeah, that's right. Oh, sorry. This is 50 GeV over here. And this is 500 GB. Okay. So this is actually with fake data, and I think so. This is one of these ones that we just sort of are working on right now. So this is with actual real data for a 50 GB WIMP, sort of plug through the whole likelihood analysis. So this blob here assumes like all the astrophysics is fixed, and just sort of uses the event rate spectrum to determine what the mass and cross section are. And this sort of outer unfilled contours sort of includes sort of our model for the uncertainty in the halo. Okay. Yes. What? When did I get my real data? Oh, the real data is. Oh, sorry. I should be clear. So the real data is all this stuff that I talked about. Here.
You mean the halo part is real, but the scatter?
Oh yeah. Okay. Back up a second. So yeah, right. Okay. So here, everything is fake here. Wait. Everything is fake here. Okay. The halo part is real here, but the WIMP data is not real, I don't think. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So basically, this is sort of an idea about how this calculation goes. Yeah, you're right. It's right. This is fake halo, fake WIMPs. Oh, just made up data. Just to use the Fisher matrix formalism, just so we understood, we had control of like what we thought the answer might be, when we put in the real data. Yeah. Okay. Maybe I shouldn't even show this to confuse people. This is real astrophysics, fake particle physics. Okay. Because there can't be anything else, I guess. Okay. So I guess I have a few more minutes here. So let me actually. I've got just two or three more slides here. So I want to talk about this a little bit, of this idea of, so before this is, the previous parts of the talk was sort of like data analysis and statistics and engineering in some way. So what I really want to talk about here is this sort of mapping between, sort of analytic mapping between, velocity distribution, okay, and sort of halo model. Okay, so this is something we've been working on. Eventually, I want to throw this into the formalism here. So to really generate a self-consistent dynamical model for the Milky Way is very difficult. Okay, as you can kind of predict. So what you really need to do is sort of break this down into a phase space density, and so the full phase space density sort of dark matter particles, depends upon, what's the phase space density of the disk, and so this E here, this is sort of like the binding energy, it's just a phase space variable, and it's the angular momentum and energy. Okay, so if you have a disk potential, this turned out to be, and you have an axisymmetric model, these are the quantities that are conserved. So it's sort of easy to write these variables down in this context. And then you basically, you have a spherical bulge and a roughly spherical halo, right? And this phase space density just depends upon the energy, which is the only integral motion in this problem. Okay, so so really what you need to do here is we effectively, hopefully, eventually would observe a dark matter density profile for the Milky Way halo, okay, which is this thing, right? And to determine what the phase space density of the dark matter is, you need to calculate the total potential. Okay, which you solve for each component separately using Poisson's equation, right? And then you try to just do this as analytically as possible. So really the only fudge here that in the slides I'm going to show coming up is that I'm going to assume that the disk potential is spherically symmetric, okay? Which is actually not true. So here's a spherical potential I'm going to assume for the disk to sort of plug into this formalism here, okay? And basically, just to get an idea of the error that you make in that approximation. So this black curve is sort of a standard Binion-Tremain type of axisymmetric disk potential, and this is the sort of spherical approximation to the disk. And here's 8 kiloparsecs or so. So maybe about a 25% error, okay, in that approximation between these curves. So basically, once again, sort of the motivation here is take like an NFW type halo, map that directly onto a velocity distribution of dark matter, okay, sort of in this analytic type of way, okay. Yeah, for now, yes. Yeah, no anisotropy. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so this is kind of what sort of a result of this analysis would be. So here's sort of your sort of NFW family models. So here's just the density. So this is an NFW profile. This is what's called a Hernquist model. So I guess in astrophysics, right, you find two parameters of this A, B, and C, right? If it kind of works, you get it named after you. So here's here's the here's how this sort of solving this equation sort of maps onto what's seen in a velocity distribution. So this is essentially v times f of v here. Okay, v times the integral over f of v here. So this is the standard sort of Maxwell-Boltzmann curve that everyone uses, sort of the standard Halley model. Okay, so this NFW, so as a result of this procedure here, the NFW sort of shifts a little bit over to higher velocities. Okay, but ultimately what you want to do is you want to do the integral under these curves, right, for direct detection experiments. So this curve here just truncates at this point because this is the escape velocity for this particular model. Okay, so let me just show you how this affects event rates. So once again, for ton-year exposures, this is the event rate spectrum that you would see, right? And you can just, in terms of these variables, you can just sort of simply write the direct detection component as just an integral over the phase space density. So here's sort of your standard Maxwellian model, and here's the NFW model. Now, the important thing is these are normalized to the same local density and the same circular velocity. Okay. So I think at the end of the day, this is actually pretty good news, right, for anyone really worried about like astrophysical systematics, right? So this is basically the differences you're looking at in terms of the two different type of models, assuming that the halo is spherical and isotropic. Okay, so basically it just gets back to the point where if you look at these things here, the width, the shift in the peak here is pretty small relative to the total width of the curves. Okay. Okay, and there's a little bit of a change if you assume anisotropic models. By anisotropic, I mean, once again, sort of the tangential component of the velocity dispersion is different than the radial component. But maybe I won't worry about that now because it's too much of a detail. But we can talk about that if you want to. So let me actually just do one more point here because I thought about this a little bit in the context of these big xenon experiments. So of course, sort of dark matter is not the only sort of particle that would make a coherent scattering off nuclei, sort of at low energies, right? So we also have the standard model neutrinos, right? That we kind of know and love, and if they sort of obey the simple coherence condition that was written about many, many years ago, then you could actually do a coherent scattering off a nucleus, and this is potentially detectable, sort of in these detectors. Of course, this is a prediction of a standard model, but this actually has not been observed. So the recoiling of this nucleus, right, coherent recoiling is based upon just the neutrino interaction has not been observed. Okay.
So these are
alpha neutrinos. Yeah. Right. So basically, just the point I want to finally make here is that these aren't actually zero background astrophysical experiments, right? So solar neutrinos is this curve here. This is a solar neutrino spectrum. And in xenon, this dies really sharply at 4 kV recoil, okay, which I think is a large part of the motivation for just setting the threshold right here at 5. So these are just different components of the solar. So this is boron 8. This is just the one that everyone detects when you talk about solar neutrinos. This is the different neutrinos that come from a different part of the PP chain. This light blue curve here. So the background, so once you go to larger energies, there's a background from atmospheric neutrinos and from all the supernova that have ever happened in the entire universe. Okay, so you ask, okay, what cross-section can you actually go down to before you kind of have to stop before, when you see these things? It's about 10 to the minus 48 centimeters squared. Okay, so from the people that I've talked to on the experimental side, they say, if we go down there and we don't see anything, time to go work on climate change or something. So, okay. So this is—I mean, this actually would be an interesting signal in itself, right? But, Yeah. This is. Right, right. Oh, there's also scattering on electrons. That's true. That's true, right. That actually, right. So basically you're asking, can you detect the recoiling electron, the energy from that? That's actually true. The spectrum's much different. Right. Okay.
assuming that you can discriminate.
And it'll spread over the cluster.
Yeah, so, right, so this is a, yeah, because this is, I mean, well, I guess if you have a directional experiment, right, you point back to the sun. But for supernova, you know, there's not a damn thing you can do. Then you turn it into a solar neutrino experiment. Right, right. Which is not bad, but, you know, I don't think that's anything that people want to be at this stage. What's that? The component from the sun. That's right. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, there's actually hundreds of events here, right? So, like, if let's say a xenon puts their threshold at 2 keV, you know, and they get a ton of data, right? You know, years of exposure. There's hundreds of solar neutrino events, right? You know, whether that's interesting or not, it's a different story. Oh, okay, that's true. Yeah, but I guess this particular, right. Right, but I guess you're talking about the just a neutrino electron scattering, yeah. Which is different than this beast here.
You could tell that from background.
Yeah. Okay, so this is just my last point here. So so I think we need over 100 or so events to really determine what we think would be a reliable Wnt mass in cross-section. But I think I want, really the point I think I generally want to leave people with is that this is a quote that Harry Nelson said yesterday. The best way to determine the dark matter velocity distribution is to measure it. Right, that's... I think that's a true statement. But it's interesting, you know, dark matter astronomy is possible, I guess, if we can get enough events. And that's basically it. Yeah.
Why didn't you use IMAX?
Oh, it changes a little bit, actually. Why doesn't it change this curve? I mean, I do have a curve I could show it to you. It changes a little bit, but sort of the general trend is that, like, you know, the peak, the shift of the peak is not really, really that significant when you're dealing with isotropic models. So yeah, it looks the percent difference is similar. Yeah. The solid line is just a standard halo model, Maxwellian. Yeah, it actually does. So it was normalized to have the same. This is so basically the idea is like just these are just changes in the velocity distribution. Yeah, but then you have to have an escape velocity that's smaller. So you can't when you integrate over the whole curve, you know. The width is actually more set by the local potential, right? So the, right. So this is more the dispersion is more related to the circular velocity, right? It's the width of that curve. All right.